Hi there, folks, and welcome to the Photo Wild Podcast.
I'm Annalise Kaler.
And I'm Jared Lloyd. We created the Photo Wild Podcast to blend together the art and science of wildlife photography. Each episode brings you stories from the field, from the technical considerations to the natural history of the subjects we work with. If you want to become a better wildlife photographer, then this is the podcast for you. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Photo Wild Podcast. I'm Jared Lloyd, of course.
And I, of course, am Annalise Kaler.
Of course.
Of course, of course.
Okay, so in the last episode, we talked all about brown bears. I mean, we live in Alaska. How can you not be up here and think about brown bears? Everybody loves bears. I love bears. You love bears. And I think I said it last time. It was like a huge component for me personally, even moving up here. It's just having that constant access all summer long.
Absolutely. And I mean, I'll never get enough of the bears, hard stop. But I think everybody who has a Facebook account and or an Instagram account and follows any other like wildlife photography group or any person, you have probably been inundated with amazing brown bear photos in your feeds. And there is a reason for that. These charismatic, incredible creatures just capture all of our hearts in a multifaceted way.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, right? Because like, you know me, I'm not the biggest social media guy out there, right? Like,
understatement of the year.
Understatement of the year, right? Yeah. Now, it's a necessity. You know, if you're an artist, especially if you're an artist in business, you know, it is a necessity to some level, right? But like, you know, for myself, I have truly over the last several years come to kind of identify summer as actually being bear season on Facebook, right?
You know, absolutely.
So like, growing up on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, where I did, you know, there was, it was like tourist season, hurricane season, then fishing season. And that was literally the calendar right there, right? And up here, it's, or at least on social media nowadays, it's bear season in the summertime.
Oh, yeah. My whole calendar is just based around like what workshop or what season or the rut or migration. Like, I have no concept of months or dates anymore. But like you said, we did an episode last time about these amazing bears, and we got quite a few questions that came in, which is awesome because we love getting your questions. We love knowing what you most want to learn about from us and what we can share our perspective on with you. But we did. We got a lot of questions. And the one that I think that we get a lot and that we heard a lot from like what our guides hear a lot is, hey, Jared, what's the difference between a coastal brown bear and a grizz?
Yeah, that's such a common question.
All the time.
You know, we get that by email. We get that when we're on workshops. You know, anytime we're doing talks about bears, bear photography, stuff like that. And, you know, it's for the longest time, right? Like both researchers and wildlife photographers have tended to look at these two different species or these two different animals as two different species. But that's just not the case. So, you know, when we actually, really the better way of looking at these two animals, instead of being different species or even different subspecies, would actually be different ecotypes, right?
Right.
So the Latin name for both of them is Ursus arctos, right? But the grizzly bear then at one point in time, I think it was late 1800s, had the kind of subspecies designator attached to that, and it became Ursus arctos horribilis. So basically the horrible brown bear, whereas the quote-unquote coastal brown bear is just Ursus arctos.
It was the not horrible brown bear.
The not so horrible brown bear. And that's actually kind of an amazing part of the story, right? Because the habitats, the places that they live, the food sources that they have to work with, stuff like that, ultimately dictate very, very different behavior overall,
yes.
Especially when it comes to how they interact with other animals. So like I said, just right off the bat, the brown bear and the grizzly bear are identical species. You could pluck a brown bear cub and drop it in the middle of Denali National Park, and it would look just like a grizzly bear out there. It would be able to interbreed with the quote-unquote grizzly bears. They would have successful offspring that they themselves could breed, and therefore that means they are the same species. It's just a difference in food. It's just a difference in habitat. And the interesting thing, right, you know, when it comes to food sources between these two different species of bears, it really makes all the difference in the world in terms of their behavior. So out on the coast, you know, the coastal areas of Alaska, British Columbia, you know, these bears used to range down, of course, into, you know, coastal Washington, Oregon, California. It still sits on the California flag, for instance. You know, it's the extraordinary fecundity of these coastal environments that basically shape the way those bears behave. So lots and lots of food, very easy living, you know, and we think about, like, say, for instance, the Kodiak brown bear, right? So Kodiaks,
yes,
believe it or not, are actually a separate subspecies from all these others, right? But they're the only species of brown bear that is a separate subspecies. And most of the Kodiaks, or at least a lot of the Kodiaks, do not even hibernate in the wintertime.
Right.
You think this is in Alaska, right? And these bears don't even have to hibernate. And that's just, of course, because hibernation all comes down to food sources. That's it. You know, that's why sometimes in the wintertime, even down in like Yellowstone, we see grizzlies, quote-unquote brown bears, you know, still out and about in January and stuff like that. But because of all these food sources, because of things, more importantly, like the salmon run, for instance, brown bears tend to have a little bit smaller bear bubble than the grizzly bears do, which means they're less aggressive, which means they're more accommodating of other bears, of wolves being in their presence, of people being in their presence. Whereas grizzly bears, very different lifestyle, living in the inland, the kind of interior parts of, you know, North America, much less food. They don't have access to these bounties of salmon runs and stuff like that. And so therefore, they're a lot more resource guarding, if you will. So we talked about this a little bit in the last episode, I think, didn't we? With this whole concept of the bear bubble or the overt reaction distance?
Yes, and we did touch on that. And I think it's an important thing to consider because when you understand the habitat of where your subject lives, like the coastal brown bear, and you understand what they're competing with, who else they're competing with, what their major challenges are, what the hurdles they have to overcome for successful living, all of those things factor into how we approach our photography with these subjects and where we're going to go and at what times. And it really does make a big difference to know and understand these things. And it also makes a huge difference in your own comfort with it. And that comfort is also something that allows you to have more success in the field. When you're relaxed, the things around you are relaxed. If you're super tense because you're not really sure and don't understand something, all of the animals, humans, bears, dogs, whatever, around you are going to be tense. So we did talk a little bit about this because it's such a big thing that people need to understand. Just like we're not going to go down to Yellowstone in the summertime or the Tetons in the summertime and expect the same sort of bear bubble as we do with our coastal brown bears any more than we would expect to have the same bear bubble with our coastal brown bears here in Alaska that we would with an inland brown bear in Alaska that's fighting with others in a very limited area for food and resources. The competition's much stiffer for less food, so they're going to have a very different reaction than a place where you have less competition for a lot more food. So all these little things kind of come into play. We did kind of touch on it, but that's kind of the quick summary from last time.
And we can actually measure that, right? So any wildlife photographer that's listening to this who has been to, say, Grand Teton National Park or Yellowstone National Park or Glacier National Park down in the lower 48 states, right? You know, they probably know the rules that, technically speaking, you're not supposed to get within 100 yards of grizzly bears. And there's a reason for that. That is the exact measurement that bear biologists have identified that inland bears, inland brown bears that we call grizzlies, actually begin to react in some way, shape, or form. Now, not all bears are created equally. You know, they have different personalities. They have different temperaments. You know, there are, you know, there's grizzlies, say like number 399 down in the Grand Tetons. You know, people are lined up, photographers are lined up on the side of the road.
Yeah.
And she just decides like, oh, this looks like a great place to cross. I'm just going to literally walk right in between with three cubs, you know, two photographers with a big smile on her face and off she goes. You know, so like I said, every bear is different.
Yeah, just they're like all shaped by their experiences. Different.
Right,
yeah.
They're shaped by their experiences.
Just like we
but
are.
We can say in general that within, once you hit that kind of 100-yard mark on the inland grizzlies, that's when they start to react. Maybe it's nervousness. Maybe they just start to kind of eyeball you. Maybe they start to stretch. They start to yawn. They kind of scratch, you know, their claws into a log or something like that. That's just kind of a, like a release of energy. But the point is, they are reacting to your presence in some fashion, essentially. Sometimes it's very negative reactions. That's how people end up getting attacked by bears, of course, you know, and sometimes they're completely benign reactions. And I would say that 99% of all encounters with bears ultimately, you know, kind of unfold in which the bear just wanders off. That's it. You know, these bears aren't looking for a fight with humans. You know, they're not just lurking behind every sagebrush, every, you know, birch tree, every alder, every spruce, you know, waiting for some unsuspecting wildlife photographer to approach. You know, it's just that they live a hard scrabble life and food is you know, it's limited. It's very limited in those areas as opposed to, you know, coastal Alaska, for instance. Yeah, whereas the brown bears here, 15 yards. That's where they start to really react to us, is 15 yards, which is like mind-blowingly close, especially if we're photographing with like 400 millimeter lenses.
Right, when it gets too close. But I think this is a good chance to segue into something else that we get a lot of questions about, because we talked about 399, for example, down in the lower 48 versus the 15, you know, the 15-yard bear bubble we have up here. And when we're talking about photographing bears up here, a lot of times with the coastal bears especially, or bears like 399 down in the lower 48, we are working a lot with sows, cubs, and subadults, and there is a good reason for that. And it's a really interesting reason, because we tend to not see the boars as close to humans because they just really don't like us. Like you said, bears aren't just hiding around a corner waiting to pounce on some unsuspecting human. They're just going about their lives, trying to source food, trying to find a safe place to eat, find a safe place to just exist. And they have enough threats to their world as it is. They're really not concerned with like adding a new game to the matter of hunting humans. But the reason we tend to photograph the sows and their cubs or the subadults is because in these human areas, and we've talked about this, you know, before, especially like with workshops, it's a really big deal to try to bring a group of humans, you know, eight of us, to an area to try
six clients plus us
into this very improbable environment where you've got wild animals. These aren't habituated in a lot of situations, and that's for a reason. And it's because these animals are coming to this location for a reason. We're going there for a reason. And it all comes down to a couple of different things, which is they're coming to the regions they come to for safety. We are able to photograph them because they are using us for their safety. And this is a really cool thing. And I'd like you to talk a little bit more about this, because I've heard you say it over and over again, and you've got a really great way of explaining exactly why this, or in, I should say, and how the sows and their cubs and some of these subadults exploit, or I should say, I don't really know that.
No, it's exploit.
It is, but they really, they're smarter than that, right? They use that smart sense and they understand exactly what's going on, and they have come to learn that strategically, they have a survival trait that they can use by just being around us.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting concept, you know, and it's kind of like my catch term, I think. You know, it's an interesting thing you say.
Well,
it's
you
an interesting concept.
Interesting concept.
Like it's a swirling vortex of entropy. So yeah, you know, when it comes to sows with cubs, you know, first and foremost, you need to understand just with brown bears in general, grizzly bears in general, right? Boars are cub killers. Simple as that. So when boars come across other cubs, not all boars are like this, but it is very common, they will attempt to kill a sow's cubs. Now, there's a lot of different theories, or really, I should say, hypotheses as to why this happens, of course. But the leading hypothesis right now is, of course, that by kind of committing this infanticide, there it is.
I gotcha.
It could potentially bring that sow back into estrus again. So sows and boars end up overlapping in territory during the spring. So we're kind of talking April, May, June, basically. That also happens to be the time of the year that those sows would be coming into estrus. So those boars are trying to mate with the sows at that time. So a boar comes across a sow with two spring cubs that just came out of hibernation with her that year. He could potentially kill them, bring her back into estrus within the next week or two, breed with her, and then be able to kind of continue on his genetic line. Obviously, we can't ask the boar why he does this, but there are a lot of different mammals around the world that do this very same thing. And like I said, that's the leading hypothesis. So if the leading cause of death for a bear cub in, you know, let's say grizzly and brown bear world is death by another bear, then that means that one of the primary concerns for a sow that's raising those cubs is to keep them away from other bears, to keep them safe. And so as you stated, brown bears, they're definitely more of a solitary type species. It's absolutely not appropriate to say bears are solitary.
Right.
By any
means, like,
right? Because
alone
if
time.
You go to any salmon fishing river, you go to Katmai National Park, like Brooks Falls, and you have like, you know, 25 bears all clustered together within just feet of each other, all feeding, right? The way they're able to do that is because there is a social hierarchy, because they are able to kind of, you know, intone what others are thinking, feeling, all that sort of stuff. So a solitary animal is not going to be able to exist in that situation.
Yeah, we see them playing together all the time.
Right, exactly. Yes, we'll see an old boar play with a young subadult sometimes, even, you know, in those situations. But so they're not exactly solitary creatures, but the boars definitely like their space. That's probably a better way of putting it. And for whatever reason, you know, we are a huge deterrent to them. Boars typically try and stay away from humans as much as possible. And as a result, sows with cubs and the young subadults very, very, very quickly recognize that where we are, boars are not. And so if they can come to a point where they can accept us in that landscape and figure out how to eke out some sort of a living next to us, they do that. And that's why, you know, for people that have been on brown bear photography workshops, you know, whether it's with us or with other photographers and stuff like that, you know, you notice that 9 times out of 10, especially when you're in these, these areas with a lot of people, except for places like Brook Falls, of course, you know, where it's just a lot of big boars or, there's a few other spots. It doesn't matter. But most of the bears that, you know, people photograph on these workshops ultimately happen to be the sows, the cubs, and the subadults. And it's for that reason. It's because you have people that are regularly coming into these areas, whether it's because there's a lodge, whether it's because it's a great fly fishing area or, you know, salmon fishing area, or because you have a lot of photographers, and the brown bears or grizzlies know that. So when we talk about, say, 399, once again, in Grand Teton National Park, probably the world's most famous grizzly. No, definitely the world's most most famous yeah. grizzly. No question about it. There's a reason that she's a sow. There's a reason that photographers are able to see her and photograph her. There's a reason that she's so well known for, you know, with tourists that come to Grand Teton National Park. And it's because she is literally raising her cubs roadside. And she's doing so in order to stay clear of any large boars that could otherwise come in, kill her cubs, and try and send her back into estrus again.
So I want to point out something else that's a consideration here, and that is the places we're talking about right now are also places where bears are not hunted by humans. This is another big factor. When you are a wildlife photographer and you go into places like national parks where they have all of this vast, open, wide territory to roam, these animals are not hunted. And we see a major difference when we go out to places where there aren't a lot of people. These bears don't have an association with, oh, the humans are here, they're probably going to shoot me, or they're hunting me. So that's not a factor in their brains that we would have in other locations where bears are hunted or moose are hunted. You see that skittishness come out in places where those animals regularly experience hunting by humans. So when we're in these places like national parks photographing animals, or in these places where it's, you know, strictly bear viewing or strictly, you know, keeping our distance, being respectful of bears, we're not hunting them, we're not causing a stressful situation in any way, you know, we're simply just existing alongside them. They also have come to know as sows, like, oh, it's people. People are not, are not going to shoot me or hunt me or do these other things that they might experience in another kind of similar habitat, but different location where hunting is allowed.
Yeah, this whole concept of habituation is really interesting, I think, when it comes to our relationship with animals. You know, so a lot of people think of like habituation, oh, it's a terrible, terrible thing. You know, you can't allow a bear, for instance, or a wolf, or, you know, a bobcat or something like that to become habituated to humans. But like, you know, what that actually means, habituation, it means that that animal had an experience with a human one single time. And that one single time, nothing terrible happened, right? And so the next time it occurred, they're just a little bit more relaxed. They're a little bit less nervous. And you add up enough of these kind of interactions between us and animals. And finally, they eventually get to this point where we are just as benign as any other animal on the landscape, right? You know, they begin to see us as just as much a part of their natural environment, of the ecosystem in which they live in, and they don't see us as a threat. And while some people probably really want bears to see them as a threat because they're, you know, scared to death of the possibility of, you know, one of these animals attacking them or something like that, the fact of the matter is, I don't. You know, when I'm in the field and when I'm photographing, I don't want those bears looking at me like I'm a potential threat. First and foremost, I don't want their fight or flight, trigger to kick in there. You know, I don't want them to run away, and I also don't want them to bluff charge me either. You know, so especially when we're working with, you know, workshops and stuff like that, you know, I think you said earlier, we're coming into these areas where there is a measure of habituation. We're going to areas where there's a lot of salmon fishing. We're going to areas where, you know, humans are a known entity. That's not the only places that we photograph bears, right? You know, you and I photographed recently, you know, a grizzly up in the Talkeetna Mountains that was 150% not habituated to humans, right? But when we have a group of people with us, you know, six or eight people
all
total, right? You know, again, six clients plus you and I, it's the most improbable thing in the world. We're going to take this wall of humanity, in which case, oftentimes, most people in those groups don't know all of the nuances of reading the behavior of the animals that we're photographing.
Yeah, they're there to learn.
You know, we're, let's face it, you know, we're humans, Americans, we're extraordinarily smelly and loud and noisy monkeys is all we really are. You know, it's like, because you walk outside and go into the woods and just be quiet and you'll notice very quickly that usually we're the only ones other than a handful of birds that are squawking. Right. You know, so it's kind of an unusual thing, but it's very, very, very unique to, I should say, primates and, you know, monkeys and apes and stuff like that in general. So, yeah, it helps so much with these situations to be working in scenarios where you're dealing with somewhat habituated bears. And so when we do brown bear workshops, that's exactly what we're doing. We're taking people to far-flung places in the Alaskan wilderness with tons of adventure, float planes, bush planes, boats, and four-wheelers, and all kinds of fun stuff like that, right? But ultimately, these bears know humans as being this benign entity on the landscape. And that's not a new thing. I do at least want to say that real quick. I see you're trying to say something real quick. I just want to say this real quick. This is not a new thing. You know, you think about it. Humans have been fishing in these exact same spots, you know, for 30,000 years with these bears, you know. So, of course, they're not going to see us as a threat in these scenarios.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I hate
okay.
when I do that.
You get all eight sound bites this time.
I just get all excited. You know, you turn me loose in front of a live mic to talk about brown bears. I mean, you know.
Let's just be honest. We turn you loose to talk and it's just going to go on forever.
Yeah, I realize I suffer from chronic diarrhea of the mouth.
But you did touch on something else, which is kind of like, you know, you don't want the brown bear to be startled or et cetera. And we get a lot of questions about brown bear safety and you don't want the fight or the flight to kick in or anything like that. And that's always a consideration, right? Like we want to be able to be present without at all sort of impacting that behavior of the bear, or I should say putting influence to make them change what they would otherwise not be doing. And we get asked a lot of different questions about that. Like you and I normally don't wear any sort of camouflage. Of course, we have a blind situation or special circumstances. But like one of the things that I love about working with the animals that we work with, and especially with the bears, is we are very calm. We are very patient. We move slowly. And we stay back and we let the wildlife decide how they are going to work with us. We put the agency on them and give them their free rein to just be the bear. You do you, and we're just going to be here.
Just be the bear you wish to see in the world,
yeah, exactly.
Right?
That's my motto every day. But no, it is one of those things where it's like, if you are patient and slow, you are presenting to that bear or that any other animal that you are not a threat. They are able to watch you and observe you and say, oh, that's not a threat to my child. Oh, that's not a threat to my food source. Oh, they're moving slowly. They're not after me in any way. There's nothing there for them to respond to other than what you're communicating. Just as much as those bears are communicating with us. And those are things that we're always clued into. And this is, you know, like in any relationship, communication is a two-way street.
And it is a relationship
is.
When you're out there in that
Absolutely.
Moment with, you know, the largest land carnivore in North America.
Yeah, and so you really, what you are saying with your body language, with the way you're behaving, with the way you're waving your tripod around, with the way you're ripping stuff out of your backpack, all of those things can be perceived as a threat or a non-threat. And I hope that everybody listening to this has the goal in mind to always be a non-threat. And by us staying back and allowing that bear to sort of acclimate to our presence, we're really calm and giving them plenty of space and agency to just go on with their lives while we, you know, move around and document them in a very safe and quiet way is like, honestly, it's so much a part of the success. And I wanted to get into that because we are often asked, do you carry a gun when you're out with the bears? And no.
No, absolutely
not.
We don't.
I get asked that. I was going to say, as a female photographer, I am asked that, I would say, like 90% of the time when someone finds out I've just been photographing bears. Oh, you better, I hope you had your gun. And I was like, yeah, I'm not going to say I didn't because I know I'm not prepared to have this conversation right now with my dentist or whoever it might be. But no, we don't carry guns.
No, we really don't. And I think what you were saying just before the gun thing is so important, right? We say that, like, we like to say that math is this universal language, but really outside of humans, when we just think about animals, mammals, whatever, it's actually body language. Body language is the universal language. Every animal lives in a neighborhood as a part of a community with a whole bunch of other animals. And so they have to have a way to be able to communicate with each other and to be able to understand what others are communicating with them. And it's through body language. And there have been so many situations that you and I have been in where we have seen, okay, there's something not right about this bear. I think of one very particular black bear in Minnesota.
I know exactly the bear you're talking
about. I got a long list
about.
Of these, but I'm just thinking right now off top of mind.
I see his face so clearly.
Yep. And you know, in that particular bear, right, you know, you notice like typically like a bear that is relaxed, you know, it's if they look in your direction, they're typically just kind of looking through you almost, you know, they're not staring you down. But this bear, this one black bear, you know, it's just, I remember 50, 75 yards away, I could just see those amber eyes of his just lock onto mine like, I don't know, Star Trek, you know, tractor beams, basically. And it's like, as he started to walk towards me slowly, he's just still staring me down in the eyes. And it's like instantly like, no, there's a problem. So they, like let's remove bears from this, right? And let's just say like universal languages of mammals. All right, I'm walking down the sidewalk on one side of the street, right? And there's a group of people on the other side of the street. They kind of glance over at me, you know, they go back to minding their own business. They keep on walking like, there's no threat level for me. You know, my adrenaline's not going up. There's blood pressure isn't getting raised or anything like that. Let's say you're walking down a different street and, you know, somebody on the other side of the street stops and turns and faces you. Now just starts to stare you down. Now all of a sudden that person starts to cross the street in your direction. That means something, right? And it's the same thing with these animals, whether what we're communicating with them or what they're communicating with us, you know, and it's so much a part of being able to kind of develop that relationship like you were talking about with these animals in the field. And that is ultimately why you said we let them basically control that relationship. You know, we approach only to a certain distance. If we get closer, it's only because those animals said it was okay for us to get closer. We're not like those, that crazy family that was just all over Facebook, you know, with like, you know, that was running after, you know, a family of black bears on the side of the road in Yellowstone.
I don't
know if you saw that. It just popped up on my newsfeed last
night. It's probably a good thing I didn't see it because I would have raged.
These people, like, you would have thought that they were like, you know, training for the Olympics. You know, they were running so fast, like they were running for their life straight towards these bears. And luckily, you know, a park ranger.
God bless
in.
The park rangers. Let's
God
just be honest.
God bless a park ranger, man. You know, I tell you, the jobs
both
have they
friends.
Have.
We both have friends who do this, both in law enforcement and interpretation. And the stories that I know I've heard about what they deal with is just like, there's a reason my favorite colleagues are animals and not fellow humans, animals.
There's a reason I photograph animals instead of humans as well.
Yes, exactly. So getting back to this though, Jared, about the whole why we don't carry guns, but we do carry bear spray.
We do carry bear spray.
To be honest with you, when I'm in black bear country, I don't really carry bear spray. But up here in brown bear country, I always have some on me if I'm going to be out in the wild, especially in bear habitat, no, I should say.
It's actually probably a good idea to carry, you know, bear spray if you know you're specifically going out in the woods to find and photograph and interact
Definitely.
With black bears for sure. You know, but yeah, I mean the let's just say the black bears and grizzlies or browns, you know, they just have such a very, very, very different way of handling things, right? Black bears are smaller, they're black, they live in forests. Their motto is run away to live another day.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, the grizzly or the brown bear, you know, they kind of live by the motto that the best defense is a really good offense.
I was going to say, we're large and in charge.
Large and in charge, right, exactly. So yeah, I, you know, like yourself, I get this question all the time. Why don't you carry a gun? Or do you carry a gun? And I think like for different reasons, right? You know, as you said, you're a woman photographer, you know, it's like, oh, you need to be protected.
That's what my bear spray does.
People see me and it's like, oh, this guy's 6'3", you know, he's got his, you know, flannel on, he's got a beard, you know, he's got a Montana license tag.
I think,
you know,
people would be
obviously he's got a gun.
I was gonna say,
you know?
I think people would be surprised at how much I am your muscle.
Yeah.
Like how much I am like your
only around
keeping
the
you safe
bears.
From bears.
Only around the teenage
only the
bears.
Teenagers.
For whatever reason. Yeah. Like, if you're ever out in the field with us, you know, photographing bears, you will find out very, very quickly if there are young teenage male bears, for whatever reason, they have this, like, weird, I don't know, fascination with me.
They just, I think they just want to play with
you. Okay. Well, I'm not playing back with them. And there's definitely been more than one situation where it's like, you're just, you know, you don't even get to photograph because you just have to tell me about the next teenage bear that's trying to walk up behind me and, you know, sniff my pant leg or something like
next
that.
Next time I'm going to make a video of it because it's really quite funny.
Yeah, I don't think people actually believe it. So yeah, it's probably a good idea. But anyways, going back to the bear spray versus the guns and stuff like that, right? So why do we not carry weapons? Why do we not carry guns? And up here, it kind of blows my mind, the number of places that I've now been to fish, you know, for salmon and stuff like that. And there's the, you know, there might be 30 other fishermen on the bank of a river. You know, there's the road. You can see the truck from there. And yet, like, half of those people have, you know, 9mm or 45s, you know, strapped to their hip while they're out there in the river. So it's, you know, up here especially, there's definitely this mentality that if you're going to be in bear country, you have to arm yourself. You have to protect yourself, that a bullet is going to be the only way that you can stop one of these animals. And quite frankly, in those situations, all those fishermen around, stuff like that, you know, near the road, bears aren't coming anyways, you know, but the reason that we carry bear spray, first and foremost, is because it actually does a significantly better job at deterring a bear attack than a bullet does. So there's a researcher by the name of Stephen Herrero. He literally wrote the book on this stuff, right? It's literally called Bear Attacks, Their Causes and Avoidances. This guy is the expert in the field of understanding and trying to quantify and qualify why bear attacks have occurred and what people did to deter them, obviously. And shortly after, I think, or maybe like during the process of writing this book, he was also in the middle of, you know, kind of like a 20 or 30 year long study in terms of trying to determine, you know, the efficacy of, you know, firearms versus bear spray up here in Alaska specifically. And so, like I said, it was a 20 or 30 year long study that he was drawing from. And what he found was that basically 98% of situations of, you know, bear attacks that occurred where bear spray was deployed were deterred. The bear attack was deterred. So 98% success rate for bear spray, whereas firearms was only a 50% success rate. Now, devil's in the details, right? When we start talking about statistics, because numbers can be interpreted and twisted and all that sort of stuff, you know, even though we like to think that they're the kind of the empirical end-all be-all of life and stuff like that. But, you know, when we look at that 98% and you look at, well, what about those other 2%? Well, in both of those situations, it looks like basically the momentum of the bear basically kind of carried it through the cloud of bear spray, and they did ultimately connect, you know, ran into basically the human, but then ran off. In a few situations, bears had to be pepper sprayed or bear sprayed several times. You know, they had to shoot them once. The bear would circle back around and come again, shoot them again with the bear spray.
Well, spray. Just to clarify, since we're talking guns.
Yes.
Shoot off the spray, just to clarify.
I'm so sorry. Yes, you're absolutely right. Thank you for correcting me. They had to be bear sprayed several different times. And that's one of the reasons when you're using bear spray, you know, and if you are charged by a bear, if you have to deploy it, you never just like empty the can on them. You know, you just kind of bump it to shoot a wall of that stuff out, you know, because you may have to use it again. So like I said, it looks like that the momentum of the bear has actually carried them through that situation. Now, when we look at the efficacy of the firearms, however, it's a totally different situation. So take weapons out of the equation altogether. Take bear spray out of the equations altogether. About 50% of the time that a bear actually charges, they make the decision mid-charge to call off the attack. You know, so we use terms like bluff charge, but bear researchers think that there's probably no such thing as a bluff charge to begin with. If they've started charging, whether they connect or they decide not to, that is a moment-by-moment decision that they're ultimately making. And about 50% of the time, they call off the thing and they take off running into the woods or something like that. So if 50% of the time bears never make contact anyways, and 50% of the time, you know, a weapon, a firearm was actually used, you know, to kind of successfully deter that attack, we really have to ask ourselves, were those situations where those bears were going to flee anyways?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. So the bottom line with all of this, again, is just understanding the situation you're in and understanding what gives you, like you and I always talk about being risk managers, not risk takers, and what gives you the best ability to manage your risk and your safety. And so in this case, you and I are both very comfortable with bear spray. And I want to say for anybody listening to this who has never used bear spray before,
practice with it.
Practice ahead of time. Don't put it in your back pocket. Don't throw it in your camera bag when you're out there. Have it on you. Like you have a, like we both wear our harnesses for our field glasses, our binoculars. And you actually have a special patch on the bottom of yours that just Velcros there, and your bear spray is right there. And I can actually hook mine right to the backpack strap on my sternum. So if that's coming, like I don't have to think about anything. I can literally, as can you, just shoot it right from that strap if I were to need to. Now, obviously, there are a lot of things we can do to prevent that situation from even coming to us to have to react to it. And there's a lot of common sense caution that most of us, I think, use when we're in the field. We're not mostly photographers. You know, I don't see a whole lot of photographers who are going to be charging after a family of black bears, for example. Most of us have a little bit more.
Unless you're on Facebook.
Yeah, most of us have a little bit, hopefully, a little bit better decision making because of our experience with wildlife.
Yeah. How much time have you spent in the Smoky Mountains?
Yeah. Oh, gosh, don't even bring it up.
Okay. Let's. Okay. Yeah, that's a can of worms.
Oh,
right
yeah.
There.
Side note, guys, one time, seriously, I had a family of people visiting the Smoky. I was photographing whitetails during the whitetail rut. And this family...
White-tailed deer, that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, white-tailed deer. And this family in a nice little SUV pulled up, and I'm on the ground and photographing this beautiful buck, you know, nice widespread. And they're like, excuse me, can you tell me what time the bears come out? And it's so hard, like, for someone like me, because I don't want to make them feel bad. They don't know what they don't know, maybe, or this is a new experience. I want them to love nature. I want them to be excited. But then you get a question like that, and sometimes it's really, really difficult to bite one's tongue.
Right. You know, all of the time that I've like lived and worked in the Yellowstone ecosystem, I can't tell you the number of stupid things that people have come up and said, or, you know, questions that they've asked and stuff like that. I feel like we could do a whole show on just stupid stuff people say in national parks.
I was going to say, like
literally, excuse
tales
me, sir,
from
what
the
time of the year does the elk turn into a moose? You know, or when do they turn on Old Faithful today?
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. It's just
yeah.
ridiculous.
But going back to like the bears, right? So another reason, and I'm just going to throw this out there, another reason that I don't carry a firearm outside of like the safety aspects of doing that is I haven't shot a firearm since I was a kid. You know, my dad took me, you know, shooting, we went hunting.
80% of Alaskans are shivering right now
I
over
know.
The thought.
Exactly right. As we hear all the guns going off lately with the hunting
well,
season
duck
opening.
Season, yeah.
Duck hunting opening. But no, it's like one of the things is my own personal comfort level with them. You know, I haven't shot at a range or done anything like that truly in decades. You know, where I grew up in rural Wisconsin, hunter safety was mandatory. We had a week off of school for opening of deer season. It was a very big thing. All of us learn to shoot, just like we do up here in Alaska, but it's not really my thing. And I know that my own personal safety is that I'm not going to be able to feel calm and collected enough with a firearm to deploy that in a situation where it's not even my best tool for prevention.
Well, and it's you think about the way that bear attacks happen to begin with, right? You know, and that's probably one of the biggest misconceptions in all of this, right? You know, people think like, oh, okay, oh, I see a bear. It's 300 yards away. Okay, You know,
yes.
That grizzly looks like it's coming in my direction here. Now, never mind the fact that, you know, grizzlies can run about 40 miles an hour, which means they can cover like, you know, 80 feet in one full second, you know, but still people tend to think like, okay, you know, I'm a good shot, you know, with my rifle, my shotgun, my handgun, whatever. I go to the firing range, all that sort of stuff. Okay, I'm going to, you know, unshoulder this rifle. Now I'm going to take the safety off. Now I'm going to draw a bead right between the eyes. Wait for it. Okay, now. And that is not how bear attacks occur. Bear attacks, that you know, that's a situation that a photographer would be in, right? You know, whereas like,
yes.
I see a bear, it's a long distance away. You know, now I'm going to kind of work in a little bit closer, let the bear come in closer to me, you know, that sort of stuff. And then make decisions whether or not like, you know, this is safe or not safe or anything like that, you know. But the way bear attacks occur is when that bear is completely unseen. You have no idea the bear's there. That bear is defending, let's say, a moose kill or something like that up in the alders or, you know, the birches or something like that. You don't know that bear is there. It's hunkered down next to the carcass. You come around the bend and you're like, whoa, what is that giant mound of dirt, right? Because bears, grizzlies, brown bears, they'll cover their carcasses. We see it doing, you know, when they catch a bunch of fish, they'll even cover a huge pile of fish up, right? Just to keep it protected from magpies and ravens and eagles and stuff like that, right? And
yeah,
so all of a sudden you're like, what is that giant pile of dirt, you know, 10 feet in front of me? And it's that moment that a bear you had no idea was there explodes out of the bushes, right? And so think about that just for a split second, 10 feet away, 25 feet away, 30 feet away. Suddenly you have anywhere between 300 and 1,000 pounds of animal charging at you that can move 80 feet in 1 second, right? And it's like, no, you don't have time to, you know, kind of pull a weapon, take the safety off, draw a bead, you know, and shoot that animal in that situation. That's where bear spray really comes into play, because it's just, even in terms of, you know, how we react with the adrenaline and the fear and the excitement and the, you know, extraordinary nature of suddenly finding yourself on the opposite end of the food chain, if you will, for the first time in your life, probably. You know, it's like your ability to actually react effectively in that situation is basically zero. And, you know, you're more likely to shoot yourself with the gun, trying to, you know, fumble to get it out. More likely to shoot me
exactly.
If I'm walking down the trail or something like that with my 600 millimeter over my shoulder. You know, whereas, you know, bear spray, like you said, you keep it attached to the sternum strap on your backpack. I keep it actually attached to, you know, my field glass harness that I wear.
Yeah.
You know, so you wear this on the outside of your body somewhere, somehow. You have the safety already removed. And by the safety, it's just this like kind of like little plastic wedge that keeps you from accidentally bumping the trigger on it. You know, and you keep it in a location to where if suddenly that were to occur, you know, if the proverbial you-know-what hit the fan and suddenly a bear explodes out of the bushes, you know, 25 feet away from you, moving, like I said, 80 feet a second. So think about that. Bear comes out of the alders 25 feet away, less than a second. That bear can be on top of you, essentially. You need to be able to be in a position where you can reach your hand to something and just depress a button, and it explodes with this huge orange cloud of, my God, the worst pepper spray you're ever going to experience,
yeah.
Basically.
And you're not running away when you deploy this, by the way.
Yeah.
Just a reminder, you're not running away. You're standing there and you are deploying essentially what is a curtain of this intense orange. It is like, don't ever accidentally deploy it on yourself.
Oh, God, I've been bear sprayed several times.
Yes. But do practice with it. And so I think we're probably going to get a lot of questions after this episode of this anyway, which is completely fine. We would love to answer any of these questions or guide you towards some resources if necessary. I do want to save some time of this episode to kind of move into some of the photography aspects of this, like now that we've found these bears, et cetera. But I think we kind of addressed the most common questions that we got about bear safety,
yeah,
and about from that last episode. So this is a little bit of a rougher segue than normal.
It's a really rough segue.
But I do want to make sure that we have enough time to kind of talk about the photography part of this so that we're kind of balancing out our episodes like we normally do.
Yes, but wait, before we do, okay,
oh boy.
I do need to add this. For everybody listening, just in case, if you don't know this, we are giving away a workshop to Yellowstone.
Ooh, yeah.
With us this winter. Now, we literally just finished up our giveaway, actually, the last giveaway that we did for Photo Wow magazine subscribers. You know, we had two subscribers that, you know, we randomly picked from the subscriber list. We took them out to, you know, the backcountry of Yellowstone, float planes day after day, and photographing one of the densest concentrations of brown bears in the entire world. And it was absolutely amazing. And like I said, we're doing this again.
We are. Yellowstone is coming up. It's one of our most requested workshops. It's definitely winter.
Okay, there's oftentimes like 50 people on the waiting list.
I was going to say, like right now, I think we're at like 27 or 28 for 2024, and we are almost sold out for 2025, believe it or not.
Yes.
So if you're interested in joining us, check out that. It's one of our most requested workshops, but Winter Wildlife of Yellowstone is epic, epic, epic for wildlife photographers.
And so on November 15th, 2023, just in case, you know, you're listening to this and it's like 2026 or something like that, right? So November 15th, 2023, we are going to randomly select one very, very, very lucky subscriber and wildlife photographer, you know, from the Photo Wild magazine subscriber list. And we're going to give them an all expense paid workshop to Yellowstone with us this winter. This winter, as in the winter of 2024.
Just a few months from recording this.
All you're going to have to do is make it to Bozeman, Montana. And then, of course, get yourself out of Bozeman, Montana again at the end of it. Just to be clear, all lawyers that might be listening to this right now. And we'll take care of the rest. We'll pick you up. We'll take care of the lodging. We're going to take care of your food. We're going to take care of parks, passes, you know, guide fees, tips, snow coaches, you name it. We got it. And it's going to be 8 days in the field photographing, you know, the extraordinary diversity of wildlife opportunities in Yellowstone National Park, all to this kind of beautiful winter wonderland backdrop, basically.
And just to add to that, I want to throw this out there because we get this question all the time. If you are currently a subscriber to Photo Wild magazine, you are already automatically entered to win each and every one of the giveaways that we do here. We truly love giving away these workshops because it is such a good time to bring people in the field and really give them a firsthand glimpse behind exactly everything we talk about on the podcast. So,
I always feel like we're like on NPR when we do this. I know. It's like, you know, when there's the donation week on NPR. So we're giving away a free trip to, or something like that.
I'm going to channel like my inner, I'm trying to think. I have so many favorite NPR personalities. I couldn't possibly choose
That's
one.
That's all it is. You're on the spot now trying to think of an NPR host.
I used to play a game. This is how much of a nerd. I used to play one of those drinking games, but in college it was like each of us had to go around the circle and say like a name of an NPR correspondent. And if you couldn't figure one out, you had to drink. That's like primo nerd alert. I know.
All right. Well, so like bringing it back to Bears podcast,
Bears and photography,
all that sort of stuff. So the thing that we wanted to talk to you guys today about in terms of photography aspects, you know, going back to our last trip, not the giveaway, not the, you know, the bears on the lake and all that sort of stuff with float planes. We'll get into that in a different episode. But, you know, back out onto the coast of Lake Clark National Park, right? We had this just truly, truly unique and amazing experience where, you know, the photography gods, the wildlife photography gods or goddesses, looked down upon us and smiled. Literally shone upon us. Crepuscular rays started to kind of break through the clouds. The clouds opened up and suddenly we had this just absolutely extraordinary sunrise, you know, right out there on the coast. And it's not just a sunrise. That's the amazing part about this. It also occurred right at the apex of the low tide as well. And it didn't just so happen at a low tide. It was during what's called a spring tide. Spring tide being when you have a full moon or a new moon. Spring, not the season. Spring as in the old English term, springin', to leap forth, basically. So full moon, new moon, you've got the largest tidal fluctuation of the month, essentially. It happened to be right during a new moon. The tide was, you know, hundreds and hundreds of yards out. And you have to remember this is Alaska. It's Cook Inlet. Tidal fluctuations are like 35 feet during these sort of events and stuff like that. And so suddenly you have all of these bears that are descending out onto the mud flats, you know, 100, 200, 300 yards off the beach, basically, to start digging for clams. And you have this thin layer of water that's only like a couple of inches deep that covers everything. And right at this moment, the sun breaks through the clouds right at sunrise. And it's just, I mean, it was like a technicolor rainbow. It was just this nuclear explosion of colors in the sky. And the silhouette opportunities that we were suddenly presented with there are unlike anything I have ever experienced photographing bears out in that location. I've been going there for over a decade now, and I've just never had that sort of situation occur.
The color was fantastic. The spectral highlights from hitting just like the little reflections of what was left on the flat there after the tide went out. I mean, it was just, if you think about photography and you understand that what we are capturers of light, and you are presented with some of the most beautiful light you have ever seen in a sunrise, bouncing off and creating more beautiful light during the sunrise. And then you have a spectacular subject like a, you know, beautiful coastal brown bear out there clamming. It's all of these elements that came together and presented what I think is probably my favorite brown bear photography situation of this entire season, if not the last few seasons, honestly.
Yeah, it was spectacular. But the thing is here, right, when it comes to creating silhouettes or handling silhouettes, I think that, you know, after so many years of leading workshops, this is probably one of those scenarios where it seems like there is the greatest amount of confusion by so many people in terms of, you know, what is the exposure supposed to be? How should I set this up? You know, I don't understand. Like, I see this beautiful thing, but my photographs look nothing like this, you know? And it's like, while it is both a very, very, very simple way of photographing wildlife, it is also a very complicated way as well. If you don't understand some of the basic concepts that go into creating these sorts of images. In fact, you know, it's actually in the upcoming issue of Photo Wild magazine, I'm doing a huge feature article all about mastering silhouettes in there. You know, how you expose form, you know, how all of the different compositional elements have to come together. You know, why when you create a silhouette, it just doesn't look right. It just doesn't have the same sort of pizzazz as, you know, ones that you see from other photographers and stuff like that. So it's kind of like a, you know, let's just say it's a tour de force on all things silhouettes. But, you know, kind of moving past that though, you know, when it comes to creating silhouettes, right, everything sort of boils down to what's called the elements of design. Now, the elements of design, this goes into all visual art in some level, some way, some shape or form. Typically, there's seven of them. And I say typically because different visual arts kind of classify things a little bit differently sometimes. But when it comes to silhouettes, the three most important components, right? It's going to be color, it's going to be shape, and it's going to be space. Now, there's a bunch of other stuff, right? There's all of the elements of design actually come into this. And this is the amazing thing about this is because with silhouettes, I think personally, because if you learn to master silhouettes, you will actually find a tangible and significant impact on all of your wildlife photography, simply because what it means is you've had to master all of these elements of design, essentially.
Yeah, so I think that's such a good point because like you, we get I hear a lot of questions about silhouettes. There's all sorts of questions about like, yeah, but what about this? And what settings do I use? And how do I do all that? Blah, 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 blah. What I really love about mastering the silhouette is I love the emotional impact of frame that gets everything right. When it gets that color right, when it gets the space right, when there's some foreground, when there's a beautiful, clean background that's not cluttered, these things are so important. And when you think about it, the reason something like a silhouette creates that visual, emotional impact for everybody interacting with your photo is because those things are harmonious and universal for a reason, right? That's why we have these standardized elements of design. Things that we've come to recognize over the years are consistent in what we tend to prefer visually, but things that resonate with us, things that carry impact or create an emotion, all have a lot of similar things in common. And so when we create a silhouette, when we have something like this and you really get down to it, it's not like anybody ever just goes out and says, well, today's going to be a great day for silhouettes because of this, this, and this. But having this skill set in your pocket when the opportunity presents itself is going to allow you to just instantly go into silhouette mode and create it whenever you see something fantastic, just like we did that morning. And it was truly, truly beautiful. I mean, you know, we had workshop clients with us, but you could hear just the excitement and the gasping and the, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. Like the thrill of creating something like that is so much fun. And it's almost as much of an emotional impact, if not more, than just seeing that beautiful frame when it's all over and processed and done.
Well, and a lot of that emotional impact that you're talking about really does come down to color, right? You know, one of the elements of design there, you know, there is so much psychology that's wrapped up in terms of color and how we interpret and how we react to. So what do they call those kind of like helmets they stick on people's heads, EEGs or something like that? Yeah, I think it's an EEG. If I'm getting that wrong, neuroscientists out there all over the world, I apologize. but the visual description there, you know, helmet, wires, judging brainwave activity, all that sort of stuff. I think everybody kind of gets the idea there, right? And so we can actually measure people's, you know, kind of physiological responses and brain activity at the same time to looking at specific colors, right? You know, blue, for instance, it's very calming. You know, that's why we associate things like trust behind the color blue. There is a reason that Facebook and other, let's say, big companies out there specifically choose to use blue as their kind of primary branding colors and stuff like that. But like I said, this isn't like, you know, kind of woo-woo, you know, crystals and incense, you know, sort of art stuff here by any means. There's real honest to God science behind that. Great book called Blue Mind. For anybody that's a reader out there, definitely want to check that out. You know, all about the impact that looking at water, looking at the color blue and stuff like that has on our brains. You're going to want to read that book. It's absolutely mind blowing. But getting back to the bears, getting back to the silhouettes, you know, what we're talking about with these colors, reds and yellows and oranges, obviously, you know, what kind of spans the difference?
Yeah.
And so it's like, again, these are colors that we have very distinct reactions to, you know, as primates, as apes, you know, we have this, you know, kind of red, yellow bias. You know, we tend to see these colors so far away and so immediately over everything else. There's a reason that, you know, people use the color red to denote power, for instance. You know, there's a reason that, you know, all politicians tend to wear, are not all politicians, but a lot of politicians tend to wear red ties, or they have red front doors and stuff like that, or like their red sports cars,
Or blue for trust as well, like on that spectrum, right? There's reasons people choose the color.
That people choose that. But the point that I'm trying to make with this is just that red and yellow and orange, of course, stand out very, very, very quickly. For anybody that has ever hunted or been in hunting areas, which I don't think we've talked about hunting and guns as much as we have on this show, there's a reason that, hunters are required to wear blaze orange. It's because you can spot that person. And you and I do this all the time. When we're up in the Rocky Mountains, for instance, we're cruising around, we're looking for bighorn sheep. And it's like, I mean, we're talking like sometimes 2 miles out up on top of a ridge, you see that speck of blaze orange up there, that mm-hmm. there's a hunter up there that's moving across that ridge looking for elk. And there's a reason that, hunter safety requires that blaze orange, because we pick that up so quickly. So when we're creating silhouettes and all of a sudden you have this just kind of like visual feast of yellows and reds and oranges, there is absolutely an emotional impact because of what those colors just simply do on our mind. It absolutely jumps out off the page in Facebook or Instagram or a magazine, or kind of leaps off of a wall when you walk into an office building or into a living room even, with a sunset like that. So color, that's why color is so incredibly important, to this type of photography. And it's one of the reasons that silhouettes, are so successful for all of us as wildlife.
Yeah, and one of the other things, like now that we've kind of spoken about colors, I want to kind of get to shape, right? Shape is also something that we all can instantly identify something or be confused by something when we see a shape. And with silhouette photography, it is incredibly important that the shape is exactly immediately recognizable.
So incredibly
important. And so one of the things, like looking through silhouette photography, like when I was culling, for example, my take of this whole setup, what I was looking for specifically in my work that I thought was really important to communicate the situation we were in is I was looking for the hump of a grizzly bear that distinguishes it from, say, a black bear or a polar bear or something like that. Like instantly that hump on the back of the grizzly is something that's very specific to a grizzly. I was also looking for instances in which the legs were either separate or together enough and they weren't muddled. So I wanted the legs to either be right next to each other so that they look like they were just one, one leg toward me and not two with like one in between the other and creating all a multitude. Or I wanted it where like the front leg was up with the paw out so I could see the difference and see that paw in the silhouette.
So let me pause you just for a second. I'm sorry to interrupt, Annalise. But what, one of the things that we find is when people are approaching silhouettes, they're not really sure what they're supposed to do with their exposure, right? Am I supposed to have detail in the subject? Is the subject supposed to be pitch black? How do I expose for this? And so without getting into that technical stuff, right? Again, that's all going to, you can read about that in the magazine, obviously. A silhouette means that your subject, means that anything solid, any sort of solid matter is black. It is black. It is featureless black. There are no details.
Only the outline.
So if you have these legs that are kind of together with each other, because there's no detail there, right? They're just one solid object. So anything that bears touching, anything that's, the legs coming together, touching with each other, it's just one black solid blob of a mass and nothing else.
Right.
So I just felt like that was probably important just to kind of define for everybody that's listening here.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. And it is really important when you're looking, when you're looking at a photograph to make as a silhouette, you're looking for that recognizable detail, but you really have to pay remarkably close attention to the details. This is a type of thing where it's not something that you're just going to go, fix in post and make it look great. This is not a place where you can get it wrong in camera and expect to have great results at the end of it. You really have to pay attention to all these little details so that the shape comes out and pops out. When you have these strong, beautiful oranges and reds and yellows, and you have this dark, featureless and only shapely subject, you have to be able to instantly recognize what it is. It can't be a jumble of legs or, if there's two bears out there, you can't have like one bear head hiding behind the other's bear butt. That's just going to look kind of like funny at a distance, right? All of these little details are things you can't just spray and pray and hope that you get what you want.
Absolutely
you have to
not.
Be thinking about these things in that moment. And so when I was culling through, as I was saying, I was looking to make sure that every single photo that I wanted to keep and take a closer peek at had an instantly recognizable shape with nothing out of place. And that was how I went through my first round. And so if you are photographing silhouettes, That shape has to be recognizable, and that means you also need to have a very clean and tidy foreground and a very clean and tidy background. In other words, they can't be competing with the shape of your subject for the viewer's attention.
Right, because anything solid is just going to instantly become part of that one solid mass. You know, if you've got, let's say, hypothetically, a tree that's growing in the background, you know, of your silhouette here, right? And that bear walks in front of that tree, well, now all of a sudden that tree bleeds into and becomes a part of that bear.
Yeah, the bear's got a tree sticking out of his body.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, if we simplify this down just a little bit, right, like, you know, going back to shape real fast, anytime you have an animal that's facing directly towards you, you're going to have an extraordinarily difficult time having a recognizable shape, right? So everybody knows what the shape of a horse looks like, or what the shape of an elk looks like, or the shape of a bear, right? You know, turn any one of those animals directly towards you and it's just a black blob, nothing else. Let those animals suddenly stand profile, turn sideways to you, and you immediately recognize that shape. So, you know, that's just a very, very, very simple way of kind of thinking about, right, you know, making that shape stand out. But the other thing is, of course, is the space around that subject, you know, around the shape. And that's why, like, you know, when we talk about composition, you cannot get away without understanding. If you really want to learn composition, I should say, you can't get away without understanding and learning the elements of design and how that none of these things technically function in isolation from each other. You know, there's an interplay of all seven of the elements of design. And so you have to have that space around the shape in order for that shape to be recognizable and in order for that color to spill into that space, right? So that way the shape of the bear stands out. You've got all of this nice space around it. Nothing's butting up against it or anything like that, confusing the mind, you know, making you think, I'm not really sure what I'm looking at here. And it's with inside of that space that the light suddenly spills through and creates, well, the magic of silhouettes.
Absolutely. And I think, like, when you have that, that's why it gives us, like, silhouettes give us that peaceful reaction, right? The combination of all of those things, from the color to the shape to the space, it just gives us that collective breath that's like, oh, that's really pretty. You know? You know, like, that's what I was feeling. I feel this, sure. Like, I don't know. I talk a lot behind my camera, like, I whisper to myself or I'm having internal dialogue all the time when I'm behind
the lens. If you ever see Annalise in the field, like, you know, everything's fine if she's over there talking to herself.
Yeah.
You know, she's okay.
Yeah, I just, you know, I like to tell the wildlife how much I appreciate their, you know, cooperation, all those other things. I like to be a photographer with gratitude. But yeah, you know, when something comes together like that as a photographer, it's really exciting. It's that same feeling when you know, you're like, oh, I know I nailed that shot. We've all had those moments where like, yes, I nailed it. And that's what it feels like when you finally nail the silhouette. And I think what you'll discover if silhouettes are new for you, I think that you'll discover that in mastering the silhouette, to your point, Jared, like getting a hold of these elements of design, I think it's a perfect exercise to challenge yourself as a photographer to try to nail all of these elements, and you'll see how much it impacts your other work that's not silhouettes either. How many more details you're going to notice in your frame, how many more pieces or distractions that you might see, and you'll really start to understand kind of how all of these things combined create such a more harmonious picture, something that's much more visual, something to aspire to. There's just, it's just a really good exercise on the whole to try to master this, because you get a truly hands-on, immediate feedback sort of experience with mastering these elements. And I'm really excited about this article you got coming out, because I think a lot of people will find themselves out in the field practicing some of these things that they're learning from it.
And that's the idea, right?
It's so exciting.
The whole idea of Photo Wow magazine, not only, you know, kind of like as our, you know, kind of catch line is braiding the art and science of wildlife photography together, but the idea is to bring people that sort of workshop level education that you just are not going to be able to find anywhere else on YouTube videos and blogs and, you know, kind of popular consumer magazines and stuff like that.
Yeah. So I would also say, I think this is a great time to mention that in our Photo Wild Facebook group, we issued a challenge to the group members there.
Two challenges
about silhouettes. And so if you go into the Facebook group and you want to see a lot of different silhouette photography from many different wildlife photographers from many different places with a variety of subjects, that's a really good place to go and do some, like, I would say, study work or pre-work and kind of look at some of those examples and find out, like, what you really like about a particular silhouette, or if there's one that you're like, I see what they mean, that maybe is a little bit too cluttery, or the subject isn't the right shape, I can't make it out. There's examples all over the map because we have a variety of skill levels in there, and nobody's, you know, wrong or whatever. We all start somewhere. So I think it's a really good learning place to go through and look at some of those and see if you can pick out a lot of the things that Jared and I have spoken about on this episode. And then please submit your own silhouette photos, because we'd love to take a look at them too and see how people are going. When we can, we jump in and we offer advice if you're asking for it. But that's a really good place to see a ton of silhouette photography and kind of see a visual buffet of the topics we're talking about.
Yeah. And so for anybody that's interested in that, that Facebook group is called Photo Wild Magazine and Podcast Facebook group. So to, you know, definitely go over there and check it out. I will be offering or issuing or whatever a third challenge that's coming up in terms of silhouettes. Dun, dun, dun. But in any case, I think, Annalise, that's our show right there.
I think
we answered the questions that that people sent in, and we got a ton of questions. You know, how do you stay safe? What do you do in this situation? What about guns? You know, I think we got them.
And I think we did. And if we missed any, you can still send them in, because we do have another episode about bears that we want to cover in an upcoming episode. And we're always open to hearing your questions, ideas, suggestions. We'd love to hear from you. info@photowildmagazine.com is our email address, or you can check us out at photowildmagazine.com and fill out the contact us form there.
Well, folks, that's a wrap for this episode. Thank you so much for joining us.
You can always find us at photowildmagazine.com. And we really look forward to answering your questions. So send those in at info@photowildmagazine.com. I'm Annalise Kaler.
And I'm Jared Lloyd. See you next time.